Emma shook her head, pulled off her helmet, her hair falling over her eyes.
Wilbur!
Emma Shaw looked from Crockett and toward the animal. It was down, its left front leg twisted, and it was obvious that the animal's leg was broken, badly. Professor Alan Crockett was up, running, his cowboy hat pulled low over his eyes, his dark clothes snow-splotched, his face a mask of violence and anguish, his Western-style six-gun in his right fist, its long barrel angled slightly upward.
Remember the saddlebags, Commander! Remember the Alamo!
I'll remember, but...
Emma Shaw drew her .45 from beneath the parachute fabric poncho, racking the slide. These men from the aircraft were friendly forces, and common sense told her to run toward them. But she didn't, scrambling to her knees and running instead after Alan Crockett. But as she looked toward the aircraft, she could have sworn that the figure nearest to it, a man on skis of average-looking height, was somehow familiar.
Alan, don't! We can get the horse aboard! We can!
But he was on his knees beside the animal, cradling its head, and before she could reach him, Crockett abruptly stood, putting the revolver's barrel on line with the animal's head. As she reached Crockett, he was already cutting his saddlebags free from the rest of his gear, a small pocket knife in his left hand.
Get the bags out of here! I enjoyed your company, Emma Shaw!
She moved her hand to touch him, barely felt at his sleeve, and Alan Crockett was gone, running toward the two land pirate vehicles, only his six-gun in his hand. Emma Shaw picked up the saddlebags.
Alan!
But he was a man alone, whether by fate or design, and the one companion whom he valued, only a dumb animal, some would say, one of God's or nature's humblest creatures, really, for all the myths surrounding them, was dead by enemy action, albeit accidental. All the loneliness, all the solitude, and the one thing outside himself on which he could rely, in which he could trust, was gone. Some would say that Alan Crockett lost his mind. Others would understand, as she did. Emma Shaw picked up the saddlebags, then ran toward the aircraft. John Rourke could feel the pulsing of the lead vehicle's engine in the air around him. Bullets and energy bursts impacted the ice near him. He kept going. There was a woman running toward the aircraft now, and a man in dark clothes and a western hat running toward the land pirate vehicles. With only a long-barreled handgun, the only visible weapon, he shrugged past one of the commandos who tried to hold him back, ran on toward the land pirate vehicles. Paul was at the aircraft, firing toward the land pirates. The female figure was nearly to the fuselage door. Gunfire tore into the ice in front of Rourke, and as he tried to turn away, an energy burst struck the side less than a yard from him. John Rourke shook his head, clawed at his rifle on the ice beside him. The nearer of the two land pirate vehicles was tracked like the one he had disabled. Its frame was that of an old truck, enclosed in the bed, firing ports there, crudely armored. The vehicle was closing, bearing down on him. But as Rourke shook his head to clear it and tried shouldering his weapon, he saw the black-clad man jumping onto the running board of the vehicle's cab, stabbing his long-barreled revolver through a vision slit. Almost instantly, the land pirate vehicle began to swerve, then it overturned. Rourke brought his attention back to the second vehicle. Gunfire from the commandos near the aircraft was opening up on it now. The second vehicle swerved, skidded, nearly overturned. There was a blast from a squad energy cannon, then another and another. The energy bolts spreading out of the armored engine compartment. The vehicle stopped. At the far edge of his peripheral vision, Rourke could see the black-clad man with the cowboy hat. Men were piling out from the first land pirate vehicle, and the man in black just stood there, taking them down one at a time.
Get out of there, man!
The land pirates swarmed over the man in black, the man's pistol barrel flashing in the sun, swiping across skulls, until finally he was swamped by his enemies. Rourke safed the HK-91, letting the rifle fall to his side on its sling. From beneath the snow smock, he drew scoremasters, one in each hand, running forward. The range was point blank. The commando swept past the first vehicle, toward the second one that was stalled out yards away in the snow. Rourke dropped to his knees beside the man. There were knife wounds, more than Rourke could immediately count, all along the man's torso, and blood dripped from the corner of the man's mouth. In his right hand, the man still grasped his long-barreled handgun. Rourke recognized it, a Colt single-action Army, almost certainly a Lancer copy.
Dr. Rourke, is it?
Yeah, but we've never...
When she told me you were alive, I really didn't believe her. Thought perhaps it was a shock from bailing out over enemy territory, or maybe she was just crazy. I think, sir, that she loves you. It has, sir, been a perfect honor.
And you, sir, are either the bravest or the most foolish man I've ever met.
There's a fine, but perfect line.
Rourke felt for a pulse, and there was none. He thumbed closed the man's eyes.
Fine line between the two.
John, that was Alan Crockett. You probably never heard of him. He was an archaeologist, a survivalist, like you. He was...
Rourke turned around as he stood. Her hair needed combing. There was dirt on her left cheek, and tears were flowing from her eyes.
Hold me, please.
Yeah.
John Rourke walked the few paces toward her very slowly, folding her into his arms, her head resting against his chest. They needed to be off the ground quickly, out of here and away, but there was something John Rourke needed to do.
You'll be all right. Hold my rifle, then.
Emma Shaw took it from him, and Rourke turned back toward the dead man. Emma had called him Alan Crockett. Rourke walked back toward the man, dropped into a crouch. He opened the dead man's hand, hefted the handgun, and shoved it into his belt. Then he took Crockett's right hand and arm, hauling the arm across his own shoulders, slinging the dead man up into a fireman's carry as he rose. In the distance, Paul and the commandos from the plane were settling with the remaining land pirates.
We've got to hurry.
Rourke started toward the aircraft, the dead man in black over his shoulder, Emma Shaw falling in beside him. It felt good to have her there. Emma had told him about this man named Alan Crockett, how Crockett, a college professor, explorer, archaeologist, weapons expert, and survivalist, had helped in faking his own death so that he could work for these past 3 years deep inside enemy territory as a field intelligence agent. And she also told him about the man and the horse. John Rourke closed his eyes as he thought about it again. Emma was asleep in the seat beside him. A human life had to have a focus, something internal or external, which kept it moving, gave it purpose. Often the external force was internalized, became symbolic of all the things in life that were good or bad or important. John Rourke opened his eyes, staring down at the different but identical-seeming snowfield below them. The Vistal would be landing at Lidveldet Island in less than 10 minutes. Then off again, back to North America, as part of an attack squadron. A few Nazi and Eden Defense Force aircraft had closed to within a mile of their aircraft, but only after they were airborne, then fallen away after a brief, half-hearted-seeming pursuit. And John Rourke could not help wondering why, yet at the same time think that he might know. He looked at Emma Shaw's face while she slept, how peaceful she seemed, exhausted as she had been, and how beautiful, although she was the kind of woman who would never consider herself anything more than pretty enough. They would be on the ground at Hekla Air Base, named after the once partially destroyed, since rebuilt Hekla community within the mountain volcano of the same name in only minutes. As he gently checked Emma's seatbelt, he considered the current situation. He was pitted against the most intelligent adversary he had ever encountered, and it was not silliness on his part to view the conflict as personal. Zimmer's every move seemed to have made it so. Rourke looked at the face of his wristwatch. In the days before the night of the war, a Rolex was very much a status symbol. He wore one simply because it was an extraordinarily good timepiece. But many persons, wishing for the supposed status that the watch conferred by its name, bought fakes. Some were outright counterfeits, others made to closely resemble the real thing. What had they been dealing with, he and Paul, in their encounter with the fake Wolfgang Mann? A counterfeit, or something closely resembling the real thing? A true counterfeit, and perhaps Zimmer had that ability, would have maintained its identity and signaled the just-discovered entranceway's coordinates surreptitiously, rather than shouting them to the night sky. But something designed to only closely resemble the real thing, yet be just enough different that the deception would be discovered immediately, or even eventually. Why had Zimmer done this, except for the one obvious reason, to alert him, John Rourke, to the fact that he, Zimmer, had perfected the process of cloning a human being? If this was Zimmer's intent, then for what motive and toward what end? Merely to have his work admired? Rourke dismissed that. Zimmer's ego was great, but Zimmer's intellect greater. Indeed, Zimmer would be a dedicated believer in the dictum that the end always justified the means. The means were the creation of human beings from the cells of unwilling donors, then using such beings however Zimmer saw fit. The Wolfgang Mann clone had an explosive charge inside its body and was intentionally doomed. Zimmer might well have used the clone as the source for his new eye. If Zimmer had cloned Wolf, then Zimmer could have cloned all of them. And indeed, as Rourke had already surmised, the woman he'd thought was Sarah was not Sarah, perhaps. There could be duplicates of them all, himself included. But again, to what end? Why, if Zimmer had the ability to penetrate the cryogenic repository in New Germany in order to obtain cells for cloning, why hadn't Zimmer just killed them? The answer seemed inescapable. Zimmer had some means by which he could record the electromagnetic impulses within the human brain, and he needed the brain to be active in order to do this. So, Zimmer wanted his clones to be programmed with the minds of the unwilling donors. That in mind, then still, to what end? In Eden, Rourke had discovered statues of himself, seen his face on the coinage. There was even a motion picture glorifying him. All this under the aegis of a man who was his enemy? To what end? Dictators built personality cults around themselves, not their enemies. Yet Zimmer had built such a cult around his enemy. Why? For some reason which John Rourke could not as yet discern, Dietrich Zimmer needed him alive and free and fighting, hence the half-hearted pursuit by enemy aircraft while their own aircraft escaped. Rourke's inability to discern Zimmer's intent bothered him less than the very real possibility that Sarah and the real Wolfgang Mann were part of the plan and might well be sacrificed by Zimmer in order to bring the plan to fruition.
Damn.
The coffee was hot, but coffee could be drunk hot or cold, and often it tasted little different. Drinking coffee these days was like a bite of racial memory, because only extremely costly coffees contained caffeine, and caffeine was the major purpose behind coffee's popularity in the first place. Yet people still drank coffee and claimed that it helped keep them awake. Tim Shaw did. This morning, Tim Shaw drank coffee just because he liked the taste. Although he'd had little sleep, he couldn't have been more alert. Word had just reached him by telephone that his daughter, Emma, missing in action after her Navy fighter plane went down, was alive and well and safe with John Rourke. Shaw was alone in his office at Honolulu PD headquarters.
Mind if I join you, Dad?
Come ahead, Eddie.
It's pretty good news about Emma, huh? That girl's tough.
Yeah, but tough doesn't mean invincible, Eddie. Tough people get croaked every day.
You know what I mean. Anyway... So you think the Nazis are going to try for you? I mean, you set yourself up with that TV crew after the fight, just in case the bad guys didn't know who you were. Only thing you didn't do was have them flash your home address on the screen.
Yeah, I tried. Well, I figured we could start us a little business on the side, Eddie. You know, sell nostalgia stuff and shit like that. We've got to get a phone number with operators standing by and the whole routine. Maybe we can get our own TV show. Call it Honolulu SWAT or something, huh?
You laugh, Dad. But if these guys come for you in force to get their revenge for all the damage you've done, you could wind up with the old tail in a sling.
Shaw reached into the top right-hand drawer of his desk and took out his .45, laying it on the desk.
Not so long as I've got my friend here. To be honest with you, Eddie, I hope the fuckers try it, and we can be ready for them. See, I can sleep, you know, take it easy, catch up on the tube, shit like that, while they come to get me. They're gonna be working hard, and you're gonna be working hard too. I figure right about now our little Nazi buddies are shitting bricks and spitting nails because we nailed so many of them right after they first got here, then got those low-life schmucks they were going to use to do the missile heist. They can't be too happy anyway. So I agree, they're going to come after me, teach me a lesson, that kind of stuff. What they don't know, I hope, is that I want them to do it. And you and the guys from the SWAT team are going to be ready and waiting.
This could take a long time, Dad.
Yeah, but it won't. You want to know why, Eddie?
No, but you'll tell me anyway.
If we dish up an opportunity our little Nazi saboteur buddies can't resist, and it's coming up pretty soon, what are they going to do? I'll tell you, Eddie. Before they hit this super attractive target, they're going to hit me. And since we wasted the no-talent bums the Nazis sent on the missile job, they're going to figure they got to come after me themselves. Six of them left, maybe, right? So maybe they'll bring some of their damn fifth columnist saboteur hoodlum wackos with them. More the merrier. We just get to put the bag on more of them, and that's your department. Just like when you had that supermarket job when you were a kid, Eddie. You're a bagger, I'm the sale coupon that brings them into the store.
This could get you killed, Dad. Emmett'd be so pissed with you. It'd be the first time the living ever haunted the dead.
That's cute, Eddie. And God knows you might be right. You think of a better shot at nailing these guys, I'll be happy to try it. But you better hurry, because I'm going home tonight, and I might cut out early.
Natalia stood up so suddenly that Annie was startled.
What is it?
Answer a question, Annie. Do you think men are smarter than women, just because they are men, I mean?
That's a hell of a question to ask. I mean, we're in a plane, in the middle of an ice field, and we're surrounded by enemy forces, and...
That is exactly why I asked you the question in the first place, Annie. So give me an answer.
Natalia had finally relented and let the air crew keep the watch, Natalia returning with her to the sealed portion of the fuselage where they could at least get out of their Arctic gear for a little while.
I don't think so, no. I mean, each person's an individual, and sex doesn't have anything to do with intelligence. I mean, studies have confirmed that men are usually better with math, especially the kind that involves spatial skills, and women are usually better with languages. But if that were always true, there wouldn't be any female mathematicians or any male writers, I guess. What are you driving at, Natalia?
I think there's something very seriously gone wrong. Is that correct English?
Why do you keep asking me about your English? You've been speaking English perfectly ever since...
But then it was a second language, and I always had to think about it. Who am I going to speak Russian to these days, except maybe some sailors or some land pirates, unless I go back to the Urals? So it's more important to me. And notice, I'm using more contractions.
Contractions weren't common in American speech until after the westward expansion period in the mid-19th century.
Well, that's useful to know. So you'd agree with me? Men aren't necessarily smarter, and women can, at the worst, be just as smart.
Well, sure. But what's your point?
If things aren't going right, then maybe the plan we have been following needs to be altered.
And?
I think we need to start the process of getting Michael out of cryogenic sleep.
But...
Let me finish, all right?
Fine, so finish. But if we take Michael out of cryogenic sleep, we'll be screwing things up for rescuing Mom.
Even when I still... Well, that's not the right way to put it, but... Before Michael and I got together, when I was still lying to myself that your father and I could...
I know what you're saying, but I never would have... You've always had all our best interests at heart, my mother's included. You're saying men don't have a monopoly on honor. Everything about you has always proven that men don't have the monopoly there, and you know that.
And I still have Sarah's best interests at heart. But we won't save your mother by getting Michael and ourselves killed. I think the situation has changed. Call it women's intuition or whatever you want.
But what'll happen when Dad gets back with...
Adolf Hitler's remains? Can you see John Rourke unleashing that on the world? Assuming, I mean, that Zimmer could do anything with them.
If the situation had changed, wouldn't Dad have signaled us?
A radio transmission or anything else could be intercepted. You were raised to be independent by your father, and my uncle raised me the same way. Maybe John's assuming we'll do something. Your father's like that. All I know is that whether John Rourke assumes we'll do something or not, I think we should. If we had to make a stand this way, Michael would be helpless. If we had to flee and the aircraft were disabled, we'd have no means of bringing him, so we wouldn't flee and we would all be killed. We both know that. Michael's your brother and my lover. We should wake him up. I just know that we should, all right?
We'll wake him up, but he's gonna be pissed.
Get your gear. Of course he'll be angry. He's just like his father, isn't he?
They dressed in the rear of the sealed portion of the cabin, swathing themselves in their Arctic gear. Natalia actuated the control for the cyanide gas. If she made a mistake, Michael would be dead in seconds, and nothing could be done to change that. Annie had volunteered to do it, but Natalia used the same logic she had with John, 625 years ago, that if something went wrong, it was better this way. Before Annie could argue, Natalia touched the controls. There would be a few seconds before they would know for certain that the cyanide gas release was successfully disengaged, but the awakening controls were already at work. Natalia looked at Michael's face through the swirling gas, then could stand it no longer and looked away. Annie was staring at her from within the scarves and hood which covered everything except her eyes. Natalia had to talk or scream.
One time, Vladimir and I were on a job in Iran. You know, sometimes the Soviet Union was popular with the Iranian theocracy, sometimes it was not. This was one of the latter times. We had to reach one of our agents who had been getting information on the Israeli effort to support the Americans prior to President Carter's failed attempt with that helicopter attack.
I remember Dad telling us about it.
Well, the only way for Vladimir to get in unmolested, you see, he didn't do well with languages, was to take me along, because it would be all but unthinkable for someone to molest a party with a woman in it. Anyway, I had to wear this chador-like thing. I mean, the true chadors are head to toe.
That's a veil.
Yes. But this thing covered me except for the eyes. Sort of like we are now, covered except for the eyes. It was hot, and I hated it, but there was one big advantage.
What?
I could carry a submachine gun under my clothes, and no one was the wiser.
Natalia looked back at the cryogenic chamber, at Michael's face. There was movement there, the eyelids fluttering just slightly. He was the most beautiful man she'd ever seen, one of the two most beautiful. The readouts on the control panel were looking just as they should.
He's coming around.
He's gonna be really mad. He just did this so we could get Mama out.
We will not free your mother by means such as this, and I know that somehow. If Zimmer will not perform the operation to get that bullet out, I have ways of making him. Ways that were taught to me.
It was the largest of several briefing rooms located at the Allied air base at Hekla, and it was filled with pilots and ground personnel. Sitting in the front row, in fresh gear, her face washed and her hair combed, but time to do little else, was Emma Shaw. She would lead one of the fighter groups which would back up the ground attack. John Rourke stood at the podium, an enormous video display screen behind him. The data obtained from the late Alan Crocker's discs were en route both electronically and physically by transatmospheric insertion flight to Hawaii, some of it already acted upon. On the podium was a control panel. With it, Rourke could instantly summon any of the digitized video images within the computer. With the fingers of his right hand, his left hand resting on the podium, Rourke started punching in time code numbers for the digitized frames he had pre-selected.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we've used up precious time already, time we may not have, but that was necessary in order to assemble the required forces. This is going to be your only briefing, which is why it's being done en masse, as it were. And we have a dual mission. The first portion of that mission involves doing as much damage as possible to the Nazi and Eden forces assembled in upstate New York, in preparation for an assault against the Aryan supremacist regime, which controls the one-time presidential war retreat. Now, from the video images provided by the late Professor Alan Crockett, we have a reasonably detailed idea of force strength. If we can do severe damage to this force, we'll be neutralizing a substantial portion of the Nazi forces in North America. And we need to accomplish that. Even now, cargo lifters are en route to a drop zone, where what armor we can muster on such short notice will be employed. These units originating in Lidveldid Island, France, and New Germany. The bulk of the damage we hope to do, however, will be accomplished from the air. Squadrons from those areas already mentioned, as well as carrier-based aircraft stationed in the North Atlantic, will all participate. We'll have the Nazi forces severely outgunned in the air, but they'll have the superior numbers on the ground. Meanwhile, as this attack is going on, a second phase of the operation will be getting underway. This second phase concerns a ground attack against Nazi headquarters in northwestern Canada. The bulk of the enemy forces which will be engaged in upstate New York originated at this Nazi base. And because of that, with these forces otherwise engaged, we have a rare opportunity to take over the base if possible, or destroy it if necessary. The ground attack on the Nazi headquarters complex will consist of two elements. The first will be comprised of a group of volunteer commandos, Navy SEALs, and German long-range mountain patrol personnel. This unit will infiltrate the Nazi headquarters complex for a specific personnel-related mission. The second element of the ground attack will be launched on a signal from within the Nazi headquarters complex or at a specified time, whichever comes first. At that time, air support, exactly two squadrons, because that's all we can spare, will come in and knock out anything outside the complex itself, or at least we hope. Commander Shaw will lead one of the two squadrons and will be overall commander for the two fighter squadrons. Now, each of you has a standard mission pack, detailing map coordinates, unit strengths, logistics, mission statements, and all other necessary data. I must emphasize, however, that the commando operation against the Nazi headquarters is only partially related to the primary objective. All of the personnel involved in this phase of the operation are volunteers. The survival of the commando force is not a primary objective. Questions?
Rourke would have gone in alone after his family. Just he and Paul both would have. But Paul saw to it that word got out, and in less than a quarter of an hour, John Rourke had a list of volunteers five times the size he could practically employ. He was genuinely touched. Emma Shaw jumped out of the half-tracked transport truck and waved the driver on. She could catch another one on her way to the other end of the airfield. Her helmet under her arm, her just-washed and still slightly damp hair making her freeze in the subarctic blasts, she ran toward the cargo lifter, which was still boarding. For a moment, she didn't see John Rourke, but there was a knot of men in black BDUs near the rear cargo doors, and she ran toward them. As the knot of men broke, she saw John, who had been at their center.
John!
John Rourke looked around, waved, said something to one of the men still beside him, then walked toward her. Dressed as he was, he looked even taller than he normally did, all in black. Black jump boots, black BDU pants, a black sweater beneath a black parka, the parka open despite the cold. He was bareheaded, and the wind tousled his hair almost wickedly. Emma Shaw stopped, stood there, just watching him. She was head over heels in love for the first time in her life, and she was certain for the only time. And he was a married man, readying himself for a rescue mission to save his wife.
I just wanted to tell you.
What?
I just want you to know that we're all pulling for you to get your wife and family out of here, and that it all... I'm sorry. This is so fucking dumb of me.
No. I love you.
Then he let go of her and walked away. Emma Shaw stood there, the wind so cold now that her body was shaking uncontrollably. He boarded the aircraft, never looking back. But he'd said that he loved her. Her knees were weak.
Asshole.
She was talking about herself. John Rourke saw her through the window, then looked away, locking his chair into position and looking to his weapons.
Paul?
Rourke was forward in the fuselage, going over details with the jumpmaster, and looked back when John Rourke called his name.
John?
Keep an eye on this, huh? I'll be back in a second.
Rourke picked up the two sub-assemblies of the scoremasters and started aft. The cargo doors there were still open, and Rourke ducked past a pallet with snowmobiles packed aboard it, walked onto the ramp and down to the runway. Emma had probably gone already. It was exceedingly cold, a fact of which he was doubly aware because he had left his coat in the aircraft. But as Rourke walked around the tail section, coming up along the left side of the craft, he saw her, standing where he'd left her.
Emma.
She looked up, but didn't move.
I just couldn't go away without...
What did it mean when you said you loved me? What am I supposed to do now, John? I'd like to know.
I don't know.
Did you mean it?
Yeah, I meant it.
So what am I supposed to do?
I told you, I don't know.
Should I wait for you to see what happens, and then if nothing happens, just pretend you never said it?
I shouldn't have said it.
But damn it, if you shouldn't have said it, and you knew you shouldn't have said it, then you said it because you really feel it, right?
Yes, I really feel it.
I love you. I love you. Know why I said it? Because I feel it too, damn it.
Sticking the helmet under her arm as a football player would have carried a ball, she broke into a run away from the aircraft. Rourke stood there for several seconds, watching her, then just closed his eyes. There was nothing else to say, nothing he could tell her, although there were things he wanted to tell her. That he respected her, that he cared for her, that he loved her. But there was nothing that he could do about it because of the way that he was made. And somehow, he thought Emma Shaw knew all that already. John Rourke looked after her for a second longer, then turned and walked back to the aircraft. Michael Rourke, too weak still to dress, sat wrapped in a blanket, the thin, very loose-fitting jumpsuit that was standard cryogenic sleep attire beneath it. His metabolism wasn't quite what it should be yet, and he was cold. The important thing now, of course, was to consume plenty of fluids, get his kidneys and urinary tract flushed out, then get some nourishment into his body. He was so weak that he was almost too weak to listen, but he made himself do that as Natalia, who sat opposite him, spoke.
And that's why we, and it was really my decision, thought it was the best thing to get you out of the sleep. Do you agree?
I think I followed your reasoning. I mean, if we have to, I can always go back. So, yeah, I guess you guys did the right thing. I don't know anything for sure now. You're gonna have to get me up and moving pretty soon. Just let me rest a little while longer. If you're right, I'm going to need to be ready to move. The thing is, we can't even try to get the plane airborne, because if we initiate anything, it might trigger a response from Dietrich Zimmer, and he might kill Mom.
I know. You just rest a bit, and we'll get you up and around. I should make love to you like this when you're too weak to move, and you wouldn't have to.
If you're trying to raise my blood pressure, it's working.
Good. But we need it in the arms and the legs, most of all. I did not want you to be helpless if Zimmer's forces tried something, and I just have this feeling that...
You've been hanging around with Annie too long, with her feelings about things. Trouble is, she's always right.
Both Scoremasters were field-stripped, cleaned, and reloaded, as were John Rourke's other guns. The Crane Life Support System 10 knife's primary edge was touched up, although it really hadn't required it, as were both edges of the A.G. Russell Sting 1A Black Chrome. And John Rourke was left with nothing to do for 20 minutes or so but think about the mission to save her and Wolfgang, and about her and Wolfgang, and about the rest of his family, his son and daughter and Natalia. Rourke shook his head. He had loved Natalia, in many ways still did, but it was not like the feelings he had, totally irrational, for Emma Shaw. She was extraordinary, and, like many men, Rourke imagined, he was at once mystified yet fiercely attracted by the openness of her love for him. But it wasn't right, and he had spent his entire life trying to do what was right. He had almost betrayed that life in a moment of weakness when he thought Sarah was dead. If he had, he would never have forgiven himself. Fidelity was something John Rourke had always viewed as being implicit to marriage, even if the marriage were not working out, as people sometimes so euphemistically put it. His and Sarah's marriage had never been known for working out, nor had they ever made any secret of that. That he even had told Emma that he loved her was disgraceful, Rourke thought, and wrong for her. He was being the sort of man he had always considered beneath contempt, leading on a woman, taking advantage of her. He forced thoughts of Emma Shaw from his mind, focusing on Sarah, how lovely she was, how good it would be to have her with him again. But it had rarely been good between them. And it was the same for his parents. His father and mother had never fought, nor was anything even suggested that they would not stay together, but it was very hard to have imagined them friends in the true sense of the word, which they probably had been once, before war, hot and cold, kept his father away. They were married for quite a few years before the war with Hitler and Tojo, Rourke's father working for what would later become known as the National Security Agency. Rourke had accessed his father's personnel file once, something he wasn't supposed to do, of course, through a friend in NSA. John Rourke's father and mother rarely did things together, and it seemed obvious that they no longer had very much in common. When his father was home, there was an extra plate on the table, but rarely was there conversation between a man and a woman who were often separated for protracted periods of time. In those days, as he learned much later from that very same personnel file, his father worked through the transition from World War II OSS and Cold War Central Intelligence Agency. For a brief period, there was no real transitional agency, and his father worked as a security consultant for one of the international oil companies. And always, unfailingly, when his father was home, they, he and his father, spent a great deal of time together, shooting, prowling the woods, building things, talking. It was as if whatever had existed between his parents had ceased to exist anymore. There were pictures of his parents locked arm in arm, smiles on their faces, the perfect happy couple. There were pictures like that of John Rourke and his wife, too. The Jumpmaster's voice made him open his eyes.
Excuse me, sir, but we picked up a tailwind. We'll be over the drop zone in about 12 minutes.
How are weather conditions?
Perfect night for a drop, sir. Heavy high cloud cover, a little snow, nice and soft. I'll be getting the men formed up.
Thank you, Sergeant.
John Rourke sat up in his seat, running a last-minute mental checklist. It was good to have something to do. In these high-tech days, airborne troops utilized a new jump method incorporating state-of-the-art control systems. The talented man or woman who was thoroughly conversant with the necessary techniques was able to navigate to the center of a bullseye target with uncanny accuracy under a wide range of weather conditions. These were high-altitude, high-opening jumps, or HAHOs. The opposite of the current method was the old halo jump, high-altitude and low-opening. Since it was no longer employed in warfare because it would be inordinately dangerous, John Rourke elected to employ it now. The wind rush tore at his clothing. It was bitterly cold, and his flesh numbed with it, albeit that not a centimeter of skin was bare. John Rourke had been jump qualified since his early teens, skydiving for fun then. But the exhilaration of the jump never left him. By utilizing the same high-tech instrument packs as were employed in the standard method, however, the potential for precision landings was just as great. His arms extended, legs forming a V-notch, Rourke floated through the night sky, his eyes alternating between the men surrounding him, Paul among them, the darkness below, and the instruments on his chest pack. Not only were there dual digital altimeters and wind speed gauges, but there was a constant readout from the global positioning satellites. The global positioning system had been implemented before the night of the war, but those older satellites had long since fallen from their orbits and burned in re-entry. There were a few of the new global positioning satellites in place, the system growing again, but one of the geosynchronous units was positioned over the eastern coast of Greenland and in a perfect location for their operation to take advantage of. The readout from the global positioning satellite provided a constant update in degrees, minutes, and seconds of both longitude and latitude, so by slightly altering the vector of one's body, assuming a reasonable amount of skill in doing so, it was possible to keep to a relatively precise flight path. One of the great advantages of the system was that it was totally passive, no signal necessary from the person using it, as had been the case with the original. Rourke was little worried about himself or the bulk of the commando force, beyond ordinary concern at least. But he was worried about Paul Rubinstein, Paul unused to jumping but game enough to try. Rourke's eyes scanned the night sky around him for some sign of Paul and found it. His friend was easily picked out, the least graceful because of his inexperience, the most rigid in body language of the commando team. Nonetheless, Paul was with them and well within the descent path. The two most experienced jumpers in the unit had volunteered to fly with him, flanking him on the way down lest Paul should get in trouble. Rourke doubly admired his friend's courage, and Paul would be indispensable once he was on the ground. Of all the men Rourke knew now or had ever known, the one Rourke most counted on. The jump goggles Rourke wore were capable of being switched back and forth instantly at the flick of a toggle between standard and vision intensification. The controls were wired along the outside of Rourke's left sleeve to a master alongside Rourke's left palm. This so that one would not be forced to alter a flight vector in order to change the mode of the goggles. Rourke flipped to vision intensification. Below him, the countryside became only somewhat more visible, but sufficiently so that it was possible to make out some few of the more significant terrain features. The perspective between aerial photo and the real thing was always difficult to grasp in the first instance. Usually it required some visual cue to serve as the identifier which suddenly made the mosaic of dissociated images take on order and meaning. Such was the case now. There was an iced-over lake, its westernmost shore forming what looked like the partial profile of a man with a large, bulbous, hooked nose. Rourke's attention focused on this until the other details, like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, started reforming in his mind, falling into place. To the northwest of the oddly shaped, nose-like shoreline lay a progressively widening notch, which had once been a river course, perhaps in the past as recent as before the night of the war, or in a past more distant still. The commando team would move along the south wall of the notch until it widened some 5 miles farther out, deepening as well, forming a gorge of considerable depth and breadth. At the point where the broadening and deepening began, however, the commando team would follow the terrain upward, toward what would be the height of the gorge. From 6 miles beyond this point lay the north face of Mount Wolseley, named after the courageous, controversial Victorian-era British soldier, Field Marshal Sir Garnet Joseph Wolseley. The mountain would most assuredly have been renamed by the Nazis, whose headquarters, redoubt, lay both within and atop it. Rourke's eyes still alternated between his physical surroundings and his monitoring of his chest pack. The readouts in red diodes were brilliantly bright, but not harmfully so, when viewed through vision intensification. And soon it would be time for shoot activation. Altimeter readings were nearing the magic number. Coordinates, as played from the global positioning satellite signal, were as perfect as they could be, judging from the computer scenario for the jump. Rourke slowly reached up, pulling the ripcord for his primary chute. As he looked around him, the other chutes were open as well. He sought out Paul, located him, and was relieved that his friend's chute had opened properly. The ground seemed to be rising quite rapidly now, Rourke fighting his shroud lines as wind gusts tore at his chute. The objective was to land near the nose-like feature on the lakeshore, not to be blown miles off course. There was no time to look for Paul or anyone else, and the altimeter and coordinate readouts were superfluous now. By manipulating the shroud lines, however, he slightly altered the vector of his descent, the chute sweeping him over the shoreline, almost too far. And suddenly the ground was racing toward him, and Rourke flexed his legs for impact, the wind gusting into his chute in the very last second he was airborne, starting to drag him. Rourke was able to roll, capturing the shroud lines as the wind and the snow it drove whipped almost cyclonically around him. Quickly, he began bundling the parachute into his arms, his eyes darting from side to side as he scanned the night, both for the others of his unit and for any signs of enemy personnel. Of the latter, there was none. Rourke turned his gaze skyward. Four of the chutes were just coming down, all to the north, but not far. Rourke looked to the mission clock set into his chest pack. 11 miles of hard travel lay ahead, and every second lost might be critical. He attacked the crushed parachute as if it were an enemy he had to subdue. Annie, Natalia, and Michael were the primary objective, the main objective the headquarters itself, wherein they would find the real Wolfgang Mann and Sarah, John's wife. And John might find horror. Buckling on the last of his weapons, Michael Rourke looked at Natalia and at his sister, Annie.
Since this was your idea, ladies, what now?
We should wait and observe. Come aft with me and we will see.
He'd already been aft once, taking only a pistol, freezing cold because of his then-still-depressed metabolism, and feeling both exhausted and slightly silly at the same time, a blanket wrapped around him over his coat. He saw nothing for his trouble beyond what the two women had told him to expect, but Michael Rourke agreed with their assessment of the situation. Something had already gone, or was in the process of going, off the graph of the plan, which altered the conditions under which they could expect to operate. They lay on their stomachs atop stacked cargo mats, looking out with night vision binoculars through the open rear cargo doors. His sister to his left, Natalia to his right.
One of us should go out there and reconnoiter.
That's a good way to get killed, Mr. Rourke.
Michael looked over to the pilot.
Agreed, Lieutenant, but it's just as easy, perhaps even easier, to get killed because we don't know what's going on. Now don't use my name in the open like that. If they have long-range sound equipment trained on us, parabolic microphones or similar, you could have blown the whole operation.
I'm sorry, sir. I just wasn't...
Hopefully there's no harm done.
Perhaps you are right about fresh data being required. I'm the most experienced, so...
No way. I won't let you.
You won't let me?
Look, guys, we could be getting listened to right now.
Michael jerked on both their arms, then started back, keeping low to avoid getting into the line of sight of any sensing equipment, then slipping through the doorway leading to the main compartment.
Sis? How's about keeping the pilot company in the cockpit?
Annie looked at him for a moment, shaking her head as she shrugged out of her parka.
Fine.
So what's on your mind?
Why are you ordering me to do something? I'll do what I feel is best, just as I always have, Michael.
I figure it this way, all right? We run the defroster system on the engines, which will get the interest of anybody watching the aircraft. If they don't have a full sensor array on us, they will then. I slip out just before that. You and Annie and the crew make yourselves a little noticeable. You restarted the cryogenic chamber, so they'll be getting a readout on that. That means everybody's accounted for, so they won't suspect someone skulking around. That's basically it.
It could work, unless they already know what we're doing, which is possible. Annie and I discussed things before we woke you up. I wasn't thinking.
So you're angry at me because you're angry at yourself.
That is not...
And there's another reason I won't let you go out there. There's a lot of stuff you can do better than I can, and I'm very well aware of that. But a man thinks differently than a woman sometimes. Even if the woman is better at something and it's dangerous, even a little.
Oh, don't be silly.
What do you want me to say?
Not that.
Fine, then. I'll lay my cards on the table. I want you to have my children, and I'm old-fashioned enough to figure we should get started on that after we're married. So be my wife. Marry me. Okay?
Michael?
Fine.
Michael walked over to where she stood, legs spread, feet squared as if she were going to fight someone. He took her right hand in his and dropped to one knee.
Will you marry me, Natalia?
Yes.
You really mean it? you'll marry me, Natalia?
Yes. I'll marry you, Michael. Yes. Yes, yes. I will marry you. I will be Mrs. Michael Rourke. And I will have your babies, as many of them as you want. Is that what you want to hear?
Michael drew Natalia close to him. It was what he had wanted to hear. Michael Rourke heard the crunch of snow under his boots and stopped in his tracks. If he could hear it, so could the enemy. All ears and all audio sensing would be on the aircraft, all eyes and video sensing as well. Natalia was going to marry him. It wasn't as if her agreement was a big surprise, but it just felt better somehow knowing that she'd said yes and that it was as official as it could be under the circumstances. Annie would know by now, probably be crying her eyes out with happiness and certainly planning what she'd wear to the wedding. But Annie was like that, one of the toughest and most intelligent and competent persons he knew, but on the other hand, classically, almost stereotypically female in her fascination with clothing and the like. He would tell his father that he and Natalia were at last going to get married. That would not be easy, even though his father expected it. It still would not be easy, because his father had loved Natalia, in many ways still did. At first, when Michael had realized what he felt for her, the situation which pre-existed between her and his father bothered him greatly. Afterward, after their first time together, he realized that he'd really never had any choice at all. What his father had once planned for, counted on taking place between them, Michael and Natalia, was right all along. Michael reached the nearest rock outcropping and dropped behind it. There would be perimeter defense systems set up. Under normal conditions, Michael Rourke could have worn special infiltration goggles designed to detect electronic countermeasures by both visual and auditory means, but the keening of the wind and the blowing snow would obviate the usefulness of any such device now. So it was back to good old stealth and a little luck. Michael Rourke started moving again. The ground abruptly dropped off before them, and John Rourke signaled a halt. He flipped his goggles to vision intensification, perusing the sprawling terrain in greater detail. There were no land pirates in these parts, the climate too inhospitable except for persons possessing state-of-the-art equipment. Rourke himself wished that they had the snowmobiles, but these would be airdropped only after the attack on the Nazi headquarters was well underway and no element of surprise would be sacrificed. They would be the means of escape from the Nazi facility with the rescued prisoners, two of the snowmobiles specially outfitted for two small trailers that were portable life support chambers, in the event that Sarah and/or Wolfgang Mann required those. For now, however, it was foot travel, and 6 miles more of hard terrain lay ahead. John Rourke turned to the man behind him.
We're heading for the high ground. Pass it on and get moving.
Right, sir!
John Rourke shrugged his shoulders beneath his pack and kept moving through the numbing cold. Hawaii had been noted for its tropical warmth, the closest place to paradise on Earth, before the night of the war. Tim Shaw was glad he hadn't lived in those days. Warm weather was something he'd always disliked, but he was never exactly fond of bitter cold, either. To him, the current Hawaiian climate was paradise-like. There was frequent rain, often there was dense cloud cover, and when the sun shone, as it still did quite a bit over the islands, there was usually a cool breeze off the Pacific, and a light jacket or sweater was the order of the day. But he was in shirt sleeves now, his knit tie down to half-mast, his sleeves rolled up, an open bag of pretzels beside him. He'd kept his shoes on, despite his predilection for removing them, because if the Nazi saboteurs came after him tonight for their revenge, he didn't want to be caught barefoot. Half-stuffed between the sofa cushions was his .45, the hammer down over an empty chamber. The little Centennial was tucked in his trouser waistband. He hit the play button on the remote control unit for the vid screen. Despite his profession, Tim Shaw was not overly fond of cop movies. And despite the period in which he lived, he wasn't particularly fond of modern movies. The morality was too complex for his tastes. For entertainment to be genuinely entertaining, at least in most cases, he felt it should be basic. And there was nothing more basic than the Western. The Western was a uniquely American art form, and rarely practiced in his day and age. He doubted seriously that a really good, authentic Western could still be made, certainly not as good as the old ones. The video he watched was old indeed. The cast included a young John Wayne, a beautiful Claire Trevor, a brilliantly debauched Thomas Mitchell, in the heroic saga of a stagecoach traveling west. When he was a young man, Tim Shaw had actually gone down to Lancer's and bought a reproduction of the Winchester Model 1892. had the barrel cut back to 16 inches, had a hoop lever fitted to it, and almost religiously practiced roll-cocking the rifle, just as John Wayne had done with such quiet authority. Eventually, Tim Shaw got it right. At about the same time that he mastered the art, he matured to the point where he could no longer fantasize that such a skill would ever be useful to a 25th century cop in Hawaii. And he hung the rifle on a wall. Tim Shaw's eyes drifted from the screen to the rifle. It only came down from the wall for an occasional range session or a cleaning. But no, it wasn't the gun or the epoch in history, but the spirit. Maybe none of his cowboy heroes carried a Lancer reproduction of a stainless steel Colt Government Model 45 automatic, but that didn't matter. The idea of standing for justice was what was important, not the tools which aided the man or woman who stood. Over the centuries of mankind's existence, battles were fought with bones and clubs and swords of all descriptions, and guns ranging from the single-action army or the Winchester lever-action to the M16 and AK-47. The reason for the battles never changed. There were good people, and there were bad people, and sometimes violence growing out of the conflict between them was an unavoidable necessity. The trick of it was for the good guys to shoot straighter than the bad guys. Tim Shaw shot straight. Now, all he had to do was wait for the chance. The nearest of the hermetically sealed tents appeared to be the command post. Michael Rourke's right hand held the copy of the crane knife old Jan the Swordmaker had made for him more than a century ago at Lidvelded Island. In his left hand was one of the two Beretta 92F 9mm pistols from his double shoulder holster rig. There was an advantage to thinking on a level that was more low-tech than what was considered state-of-the-art. When someone wished to know what was going on inside a military tent these days, all sorts of electronic gadgetry could be utilized. Why bother to physically approach the tent, perhaps go inside, risking life and limb? Therefore, such direct physical action was little guarded against. Michael hesitated. If he sliced through into the tent, he could avail himself of whatever classified materials might be inside. Provided they were on Claire, he would have useful data. On the downside, however, he would, in relatively short order, alert the enemy that something was afoot. As he'd moved along the perimeter of the encampment which surrounded the aircraft, in which Natalia, Annie, and the crew were waiting, he'd detected several anomalies. First, although there were quite a number of vehicles and tents, there seemed to be very few personnel. Either guarding the aircraft was suddenly a low-priority task, or this was just a show. With all the equipment Natalia and Annie had reported seeing, flying east, Michael Rourke now wondered if the mission to the east were some sort of emergency or pre-planned. If pre-planned, why have two operations going simultaneously when, it appeared, there was a shortage of personnel? Or was that planned too? His father and Paul had flown east in their attempt to fulfill Dietrich Zimmer's bizarre demand in exchange for performing the required operation on Michael's mother. Was this some elaborate trap to capture his father and Paul? But then why not all of them? Himself, Annie, and Natalia included. And he, Michael, was supposed to be Martin in cryogenic sleep, part of a trade for Sarah Rourke's life. Was it that Dietrich Zimmer just didn't care about Martin? That this was all a sham? Or was this casual attitude toward Martin all part of a plan as well? Did Dietrich Zimmer know that Martin was dead? Then why the charade? Michael Rourke reached a decision. He was damned if he entered the tent to steal information, yet might be damned if he didn't. Glancing from side to side, double-checking his earlier assessment that he'd bypassed the tent's rather lackluster intruder defense system, he stabbed the knife into the fabric, and just as in the old videotapes he'd watched at the retreat, cut his way into the Arab-Indian tent. Michael lengthened the cut and stepped through, squinting his eyes against the brighter light. There was no one about in this compartment, and as rapidly as he could, Michael sealed the rift in the tent's outer wall with the modern equivalent of duct tape. Like his father, Michael Rourke planned ahead. He waited near the tent wall for several seconds until his eyes were fully accustomed to the brighter light. Michael pushed back the hood of his parka. Beneath it, he wore a black toque, the hood-like garment masking his face completely except for the eye holes. He left the black hood in place. If he were discovered, there was no sense in advertising his identity. Opening his coat against the warmth, a pistol in one hand again, the knife in the other, he crossed the small room. It was used for storage of message blanks, coffee, innocuous things like that. There was also a box of grenades. Michael already had some of his own. He reached the doorway leading to the main section. Michael stuffed the Beretta into the waistband of his trousers, his sweater pulled up enough that he could grab the pistol's butt if need be. He turned the knob as slowly as he could. The door opened now, about 6 inches. Michael peered through. The computer operator's back was to the doorway. There was no one else in the main compartment. 3 desks, a radio set, various monitors, a second computer console, and a stack of assault rifles were all that remained in the compartment. This was a typical field command post, communications equipment, data processing, all instantly portable. Michael was beginning to wish he'd brought Natalia along. She was good with computers, just like Paul. He was not more than adequate, but learning. He continued opening the door, widening it at last until he could slip through. The snow had already melted from his boots. The floor of the structure was carpet-like material. If he could approach silently enough, there was at once the chance that he could do what he came to do unmolested, and that he would not be forced to kill the man sitting at the computer keyboard. Michael Rourke, the knife in his right fist in a saber hold, started moving, walking slowly toward the Nazi. During the 5 years in which his father had left cryogenic sleep and joined Michael and his sister, many things were learned. One of the skills his father taught them both had to do with the versatility of the knife as both a tool and a weapon.
You know how much I'm into gun guys, right? But if I had to choose one weapon only, I'd choose a knife. The reason for that is because a good knife, if it isn't abused, can be used over and over again. Now, eventually, you're going to run out of ammunition. Even if you had the facility to reload your own, eventually the cases will become unusable. A flintlock rifle, probably the most practical survival weapon you can have. I mean, you can make your own powder, your shot, and mine your own flint. Well, it will cease to function under conditions of extreme dampness. It can't be used in water at all. It needs to be reloaded between shots. A good knife, on the other hand, doesn't run out of ammo. It can be used regardless of weather conditions. Won't fail you unless you use it improperly. You know I like big knives for some purposes. One of the reasons is that with a really large knife, you don't always have to use it as a knife in any personnel work. You can use it as a club.
There were 2 ways of doing just that. One utilized the spine of the blade. The second method worked with any large knife. It was the second method which Michael Rourke was about to employ. He was fewer than 4 feet from the man at the computer console, still keeping his concentration on things other than the man himself. Whether it was some sixth sense only activated in times of mortal peril or just coincidence combined with superstition, there was an old rule in sentry removal, applicable here. Don't think about the target. Michael rotated the knife slightly in his hand, primary edge out. His right arm raised, then arced downward, crushing the left flat of the blade downward. From the pocket of his parka, Michael withdrew the modern equivalent of flex cuffs, binding the Nazi computer operator's wrists behind him, then the ankles. With a piece of the duct tape he'd used to close the cut in the tent wall, he closed the man's mouth, first checking with his gloved fingers for any obstructions to the air passage. Dentures, uncommon these days, or the like. Michael left him beside the chair, then went to the tent's main entrance. There would be guards outside, but there was nothing to indicate they had been roused. This was almost too easy, and perhaps it was that way because it had been planned to be. Had Michael killed the man working at the computer console, it would not have bothered a man such as Dietrich Zimmer at all. Regardless of whether or not this was some elaborate setup, Michael set about his work. He sat at the computer console, exploring the program on which the now unconscious man had been working. The program revealed force strength data, and from what Michael was able to determine, the Nazi headquarters some 5 miles distant was severely undermanned. That made even less sense. Michael printed out the data, which seemed most interesting, after the file was loaded into the printer's memory buffer, beginning to search the hard disk for additional data. At last, he was able to access another file. This contained information which, by all rights, didn't even belong in a system the primary purpose of which was expediting a military operation. Why was it here? The data concerned Dr. Zimmer's experiments with cloning human beings. Zimmer had, the file related, successfully discovered the means by which to record the electromagnetic impulses of the human brain. He could probe through the brain, probably not very pleasant for the subject, and extract data. This was of considerable value to his military intelligence operations. No longer were torture, drug therapy, or any other technique for the extraction of information against a subject's will required. Zimmer's probe replaced all of that. Michael realized, as he digested the information, that the main fault intrinsic to Zimmer's new technique was the sheer volume of information which would be obtained. There was no one specific area of the brain which held memory. There were instead cells throughout the brain, billions of them. And within these were subtle electrochemical connectors which strung together. When one saw a tall, four-legged animal with an odd sort of chair on its back, myriad receptors processed and interpreted the data, which instantly allowed the identification of the creature as a saddled horse. The volume of data which would be extracted by, in essence, recording the brain was enormous, too much for even the most sophisticated of computers to process. Hence the cloning. Zimmer had available a bank of living human beings kept in a state of suspended animation, probably cryogenic sleep, whose sole function was the reception of such data. Transglobal Alliance Secret Agent X was captured, the electromagnetic impulses within his brain recorded, the information downloaded into one of the cryogenic sleepers awakened for the specific purpose of receiving the information. The cryogenic sleeper, according to the data, had previously implanted within his or her brain an electronic device which could be utilized to stimulate pleasure or pain. Should the human being receiving the downloaded information be endowed as well with the original subject's will and concurrent desire not to release the data, it was a simple matter to manipulate these pleasure and pain centers in order to convince the human receptor that answering all questions and divulging all information was the correct thing to do. Michael instantly wondered why Zimmer went to all of the trouble. Why not simply place such a device in the brain of the interrogation subject? As Michael read on, that question was answered. Recovery from such an operation was estimated at a rate of 75%. What if the subject died? Then the intelligence data would be lost forever. And it was possible that while performing the operation, the subject would be damaged. That could mean specific areas of memory loss, tiny details which might prove vital, gone. Michael regretted his meager German because much of the data was in vocabulary which was well beyond him. Natalia, on the other hand, had perfect German. The first file was printed, and Michael set about printing this one. The notes beside the computer console dealt with forces deployment, specifying guard rosters and the like for the encampment surrounding the aircraft. It was obvious to Michael that the information in the file was intended for him or one of the others from the family to see, to use. But why? Was there some secret ally within the Nazi headquarters? Or was it Dietrich Zimmer manipulating them to his will? Michael Rourke scanned through the rest of the files, finding few things of any real interest. As soon as the file concerning Zimmer's cloning experiments and the other data pertinent to them was printed, he would be on his way.